Three, two, one. Political Breakdown is a daily politics podcast from KQED in San Francisco that goes deep into the issues you care about. I'm Scott Schaefer.
And I'm Marisa Lagos. Look, 2024 is gonna get weird.
Who decides when there's been an insurrection or not?
We're still in the innovation phase of AI.
And that is where you see that they're not actually being equitable and trying to build a utopia where we can all use drugs happily together.
But whatever happens this election year, the KQED Politics team is in this with you. Political Breakdown. Find it wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey, it's Sophie, the producer. Before we get started, I have a request. We're working on some upcoming shows, and we want your help. We want to know what you want to know about. Send us your questions, no matter how big or how small, even the ones you're embarrassed to ask. Shoot us an email to weeds@vox.com. Okay, on to the show.
I'm Jonquilin Hill. This is The Weeds. America is in the midst of a homelessness crisis. Since 2016, the number of people who are unsheltered has been on the rise. And from 2022 to 2023 alone, homelessness went up over 12%. That's a steep jump compared to the steady rise we've been seeing over the past 8 years. If you see more encampments on your daily commute or notice more unhoused people in your neighborhood, you aren't imagining things. On one hand, this has raised awareness, which can be a good thing. More Americans view homelessness as a serious problem. On the other hand, that concern doesn't always translate to meaningful, humane change. In fact, it's led to political tension throughout the country, and it's gone beyond neighborhood listservs and local governments. Even the Supreme Court has decided to weigh in.
So the court is going to answer this question of, does it violate the Constitution? Is it a cruel and unusual punishment to jail or fine someone for sleeping outside on public property if there's nowhere else for them to go?
The case is the city of Grants Pass versus Johnson, but the story doesn't start there.
My name is Rachel Cohen, and I cover policy for Vox.com. You can't really understand this case without knowing another case that happened a couple years earlier, and that case is called Martin v. Boise, which dates back to 2009, but was decided in 2018. In that case, this man named Robert Martin, that's where the Martin comes from, and a group of other homeless people with him in Boise, Idaho, they sued saying that the police citations they were getting for sleeping outside violated their constitutional rights. And this case went all the way up to the Ninth Circuit, and the Ninth Circuit agreed with them, and they ruled in favor of the homeless plaintiffs and said, yes, it does violate the Eighth Amendment to punish these people for sleeping outside, given that Boise, Idaho had nowhere else for them to go. The problem, of course, is that all of these governments have failed to build enough housing for decades, and they have this massive housing shortage, and their existing housing is so expensive, and many of these states just don't have enough shelter beds. The Martin decision has basically just provided a new constitutional check on what governments can do about these new and politically unpopular tent encampments that are cropping up everywhere. Grants Pass is very similar to Martin v. Boise in that it concerns the rights of unhoused people in situations where they have nowhere else to go. I think the big distinction in this case is that it involves more looking at sort of fines and fees rather than straight criminal penalties. Grants Pass is this town in Oregon, and it's a similar situation where you had a couple of unhoused people who were sleeping outside. The lead plaintiff was actually this woman named Deborah Blake. She had been homeless for about a decade, and in that time, she had racked up so many fines and fees from Grants Pass that she owed over $5,000. Deborah Blake ended up actually passing away at age 62 in 2021, so it was renamed for another homeless plaintiff, Gloria Johnson. So she's the lead plaintiff, but there's a, you know, a handful of them, and they all have experienced this situation where they've just received a bevy of financial penalties for sleeping outside. Now, advocates would say, you know, if you get enough fines and fees and you can't pay them, that turns into criminal penalties eventually. But the plaintiffs of the Grants Pass case are saying, you can't restrict us so much from dealing with people breaking our laws. Like, you can't say we can't even give them a ticket or we can't even give them a fine.
The Supreme Court declined to hear Martin v. Boise back in 2019. But things have changed since then.
So the main thing that's changed is just that the affordable housing crisis and the homeless crisis has gotten so much worse. It's just such a more severe political problem out west than it was in 2018. Voters are more upset about it. On the legal front, honestly, not that much has changed. It's actually a little unusual that the Supreme Court would agree to take up this case because it's not like there's been a lot of split circuit courts disagreeing with one another, which is usually what happens when the Supreme Court says, okay, we'll settle this question. There's been some judges on the West Coast who have kind of quibbled, but there's been no actual federal circuit court decision saying this was wrong. So I think the main answer is just that there's been this political crisis and you have powerful leaders like Democratic Governor Gavin Newsom saying the courts have got this wrong, you need to fix this, and the Supreme Court has agreed to look at it.
After the break, what's driving the homelessness crisis and why it's so hard to get good data?
Support for The Weeds comes from Not Another Politics Podcast from the Harris School of Public Policy. With the constant news cycle, there's a lot of noise out there. Opinions are plastered all over social media, pundits are throwing out hot takes without any sort of context, and it's only getting worse as we dive farther into election season. We know that if you're listening to us at The Weeds, you're looking to cut through all this. And if you like this show, you might like Not Another Politics Podcast. Not Another Politics Podcast is produced by the University of Chicago Harris School of Public Policy. They want to take a research and data approach to analyzing hot button issues and offer perspectives that go beyond the headlines. They cover a wide variety of topics in their episodes, but a few recent episodes that you can listen to include a deep dive into why women are underrepresented in U.S. politics or whether or not we can believe political surveys. You can listen and subscribe today at harris.uchicago.edu/NAPP. That's N-A-P-P.
Support for The Weeds comes from Mint Mobile. After years of pulling our bifocals to read the fine print, we're pretty used to asking, what's the catch when we see a deal that seems too good to be true? Well, with Mint Mobile, there is no catch. That's because their secret sauce is that they sell all of their wireless services online. They say they cut out the cost of retail stores and pass those sweet, sweet savings directly to you. For a limited time, their premium wireless plans are just $15 a month when you purchase a 3-month plan. All plans come with high-speed data and unlimited talk and text delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. To get this new customer offer and your new 3-month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, you can go to mintmobile.com/weeds. That's mintmobile.com/weeds. You can cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/weeds. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first 3-month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
Michael Cohen, Trump's former attorney, fixer, and friend, testified this week in Manhattan.
Todd Blanche is upset because he knows that he looks like a fool right now representing Donald Trump. It is the stupidest opening to a cross-examination I have ever heard, and I have heard a lot of stupid stuff.
I'm Preet Bharara, and this week, Katie Fang, host of MSNBC's The Katie Fang Show, joins me on my podcast, Stay Tuned with Preet, to talk about the latest court news from Trump's trial. The episode is out now. Search and follow Stay Tuned with Preet wherever you get your podcasts.
We're back. It's The Weeds, and I'm talking with Vox's Rachel Cohen. Rachel, what do we mean when we talk about the unhoused population? You know, I think when people think of homelessness, they think of something maybe like tent encampments, but it's so much more than that. Who are we talking about when we talk about the homeless population?
This is such a great question because it's a question so many people have, and it's also so frustratingly hard to just answer straightforwardly because there are all these debates about how do we count it, what counts, and sort of definitions. But I'm going to do my best to answer this question. So people living in tent encampments fall under the bucket of what's known as unsheltered homelessness. And that's people who are sleeping anywhere that's not primarily designed for someone to sleep. So like a train station, outside in a park or an alley or a car. Then we have what's known as quote unquote sheltered homelessness, which I don't think is a great term, but that refers to people who are staying in these emergency shelters. Then there's all this other kind of homelessness that's a lot harder sometimes to see. It doesn't always show up in government statistics, but it could be people when you have multiple families crowded together in, you know, a one-bedroom apartment, like more people in a space that shouldn't be there, or people who are couch surfing because they have nowhere permanent to go home to, or families staying in motels. And I think the Grants Pass case is really going to affect the unsheltered homelessness population. I think that's where you're going to see the greatest impact for right now. But as you can imagine, these groups, people go into different categories and the lines are porous. And, you know, you might be couch surfing one day and then on the street another day.
What do we know about the scope of the crisis in the United States? How much homelessness is there here?
Even just to your point, like some people don't like to identify as homeless. So, you know, that also can make it challenging to count. To answer your question, though, we know homelessness is going up. And importantly, we also know that unsheltered homelessness is going up. And it's been going up since 2016. Once a year, the government does this thing in January called the point in time count, where people go out literally and try to count everyone they can find sleeping in shelters and on the street. So that doesn't include these other people we were talking about, like people who might be doubling up or just bouncing around. But they at least try to capture those first two categories. And the most recent one found that there were more than 650,000 people on a single night in January experiencing homelessness. And that was a 12% increase from the year before. So that's a big jump. And of those 650,000 people, roughly 40% were experiencing unsheltered homelessness, so not staying in emergency shelters and sleeping in places like tents and on the streets.
What's the leading cause of this homelessness? Why are people unhoused?
Yeah, I mean, sometimes people try to complicate it, but it is pretty straightforward. The leading cause is there's a lack of affordable housing. People can't afford their rent, housing costs keep going up, and there isn't enough housing to go around. So the affordable housing crisis is so inextricable from our homeless crisis. And we know this because actually HUD data showed that the rise in homelessness is really due to people experiencing homelessness for their first time.
I think something that's interesting is that these two cases we've talked about in Boise, in Grants Pass, both of them take place in the western part of the United States. And I wonder what role location is playing in all of this.
Yeah, I mean, I think it goes back to the housing crisis. The West Coast has some of the worst housing shortages and some of the highest housing costs. So you see a lot more unsheltered homelessness there. I think also because of the warmer climate, the West Coast also just has a little bit less of a emergency shelter culture than the East Coast does, because we have colder winters. So you're having more people unable to afford housing, and the weather is a little bit more tolerable to stay outside. And so even though they desperately need more shelters for people to go to, they've sort of behind on building those compared to like New Jersey or Washington, D.C.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned, you know, the hypothermia aspect of it. Like both of you and I live in D.C. And when it gets too hot or gets too cold, we get like these city notices saying like, hey, if you know someone, there's a shelter available. And I think sometimes people think like maybe people experiencing homelessness are traveling west to, but that's not the case here.
Right.
Yeah.
And I do think it's important to note that like homelessness is going up across the board. It's not just on the West Coast. Last year, actually for Vox, I went and did a report on homeless tent encampments in Maine, and they've really seen a huge jump over the last 4 years too. And the federal government put out something in December that found more than 60% of their what they call continuums of care saw growth in unsheltered homelessness last year. And that was also in rural and suburban communities. Like, I think people who want to overturn the Grants Pass and Martin v. Boise decisions, they like to blame the courts for their problem. And, you know, the response to that is like, well, this problem is really happening all over. So is it really due to those court decisions?
One thing I can't help but wonder, you know, we know that there's been this massive increase in homelessness, and a lot of that is due to housing. But I also wonder, is it worse than it used to be, or are people just confronted with it now? Is it something that previously people didn't have to see? Because a lot of the quote unquote solutions that come up feel more like, oh, how do we keep people who are housed from seeing people who are unhoused versus how do we get people into housing?
I think there's so much truth. I think the political problem is worse. We do know that unsheltered homelessness is worse. And I think that's because the housing crisis has gotten worse. You know, it really is a response to something that has been let fester over 20 or more years. And we're really seeing that kind of come home to roost right now. But it's definitely true. Like, it's easier to ignore the homeless crisis if what you're referring to are families with kids who are bouncing around you. You don't have to see them. The crisis is in people's face more, so they're more upset about it. And this is also, I think, what is really scary to see is as voters are more upset about it because they don't like to see it, there's more pressure on politicians to do something. But, you know, the thing that they could really do to address the problem will take time. And they're sort of hearing from people who don't want to wait for something that takes time.
It's almost sort of like, you know, there's a lot of hand-wringing in D.C. where people are like, oh, crime is up. And, you know, it's not to deny the fact that these things are happening. But it is that question of like, okay, is crime up or are you just seeing more behavior you don't like on a day-to-day basis?
Yeah, and I think the reaction around crime and homelessness is being so closely linked in so many cities.
Yeah, they're conflated a lot. It feels like it's conflated.
They're conflated a lot, and now people are adding the migrant crisis to it. Like, all of these things are getting kind of, like, so politicized and weaponized.
These jurisdictions are arguing that the ruling in Boise means they can't enforce the policies that they want to implement to fix the homelessness problem, that they're hamstrung by the issue. Are they?
I think this goes back to what we were just talking about, which is like, there's kind of a couple of problems. It kind of hamstrings them from their immediate political problem, which is like they have people calling them, their office mad, and they want them to do something, or business owners are upset, or maybe a company is starting to leave and they don't really have anything they can instantly do to solve that problem. But the idea that these court decisions are hamstringing them from addressing the homeless crisis, that doesn't really make any sense, because the way to solve the homeless crisis is to build more housing. It's to add more shelter beds. You know, governments need to do that in order to solve their homeless crisis. And the court cases are saying, yes, you need to do that. And if you don't, you can't fine or criminalize these people who don't have any other options.
There are no simple answers when it comes to solving the homelessness crisis, but there are innovative solutions worth exploring. That's next.
This week on The Pitch, we're back to pitches. And this one's coming from my job.
What Podcast AI does is it lets podcast producers become 10 times more productive.
How much are you charging The Pitch?
We're charging $99, and Josh came in right before we doubled our prices.
What's keeping something like a Restream from just going like, yep, we do all this AI now stuff too?
So there's a lot of these older companies that are tacking on AI, and that's kind of the issue. They're tacking it on.
You built this really quickly. What's to stop anybody else from doing this? What's the moat?
How do you build a moat when you're building with AI? That's this week on The Pitch. Go right now and subscribe to The Pitch wherever you listen to podcasts.
Okay, Rachel, I want to get into the stakes of this. What happens if homelessness does essentially become criminalized more so than it is already?
This is something, and I've just really been calling up all these people, asking them this question, like, what do you think would happen, reading all the briefs? And really, if there's not more housing, it makes it easier to sweep encampments. You're just really increasing the likelihood that more people are going to end up in these situations. Now, I do want to say, after the Dobbs v. Jackson decision, the one that overturned the right to abortion, We did see some states step up and pass more affirmative protections on reproductive rights. It is totally possible for some states to increase protections for homeless people if the Supreme Court, you know, issues a ruling that restricts their rights. Like, more states could then step up and say, well, we're going to protect your rights on a state level. But obviously, that is no guarantee. And a lot of people in the public are less sympathetic to homeless people than they are to reproductive rights.
Would this decision only apply to Ninth Circuit jurisdictions, or, you know, could this become a national trend, these policies?
Oh, definitely. Could apply everywhere. I think every jurisdiction is watching this case because the Martin v. Boise and Grants Pass decision, nobody wants to be sort of in a position where they could be told they violated the Constitution. That's just a huge nightmare. And I think even though it hasn't technically been law over them, like, no state in Vermont wants to do something that could expose them to that kind of litigation. And I think a lot of cities are dealing with tent encampment problems, even on the East Coast or in the Midwest. And if they get sort of the signal from the Supreme Court, like, you're on safe legal ground to kind of handle this, I think we will see more sort of like uninhibited, maybe more less restrained sweeps to encampments.
Yeah. In your reporting, have you seen any cities take different or innovative approaches to address the crisis? You know, what are some of the needs here?
Do you mean the homeless crisis? Do you mean which crisis? There's so many crises.
We are in a constant state of crisis.
I think I have seen some different cities do different approaches, and yet we also really lack a very great comprehensive understanding of how different cities are responding to this and sort of the effects and consequences of those different approaches. But HUD sort of paints it as a range of, like, there's four different categories, and on the far end is sort of like sweeps with no supports, and you just kind of like give no notice and the police come in and they tell everyone to leave and scatter, and that's it. On the other end are cities that say, like, we're going to let you stay here, we're going to bring you some showers and trash services and some medical services, but you have to, like, stay in this one area and we won't punish you. And then the most common approach right now is sort of more like, we're going to tolerate it for a little bit, but if we get too many complaints from the community or after a while, we'll probably give you 2 weeks' notice to leave, and then we'll probably make you scatter even though we don't really know where you'll go, and even though we don't actually have enough housing for you, and even though we know scattering people like that tends to make things worse in the long term. That's kind of been the main strategy, and I think there's a lot of desire amongst homeless advocates for there to be a just much more humane set of norms of how to handle this. But I would say at this point, cities are all doing kind of slightly different things, but they're all like looking to each other, being like, what are we allowed to do? What should you do? How did that work? And one thing that's been coming up is this idea of citizen complaint portals. It's just like a way to solicit feedback from community members. And it's also a way that people can very easily, you know, file concerns or complaints that they have. Now, we know who tends to issue these complaints more than others. They tend to be higher income people. They tend to be people who own homes. They're not inherently bad. It's not obviously bad to be collecting feedback, but complaints are a more negative framed thing. And what we see in practice is that local governments say, oh, well, I received 27 complaints about this encampment, so we really have to do something. And they use the total number of complaints as sort of a reason to then clear them or do something else. And some communities, including Washington, D.C., are actually experimenting with something that's very simple but actually offers a really different way to think about it. And they're calling them help portals. So instead of complaints, you submit something saying, like, I think this person could use more, you know, sanitation, or I think we could really use some help with, like, this problem. And it's just a way to sort of recenter the needs of the vulnerable person in the feedback that you're submitting. There hasn't been, like, you know, great research yet on how that's worked or what it does. But I think, like, just being really more conscious about things like that. Like, if you submit a lot of complaints, that's going to really end up eliciting a different response than if you submit a lot of, you know, tickets for help or something like that.
why hasn't there been much research into these help portals or these other outreach solutions?
I think because unsheltered homelessness wasn't as big of a problem, it just, there also wasn't that much research. Like HUD really didn't start looking at it until like 2018, basically. And they're trying to get more data now, but it's sort of slow going. These are populations that are really hard to study. You know, they're not, they don't trust, you know, researchers necessarily. There's a lot of suspicion. And then I think a big thing, since we're talking about criminalization, I really think that's what this Supreme Court case is going to be about. We don't have a lot of transparency into like police department policies around homeless people. Do they have to be the ones doing it? Because anytime you obviously increase interactions with law enforcement, you're raising the risk that that could, you know, end up in some sort of criminal situation.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. Like a few weeks ago, actually, this was back when it was really cold here in DC. I was getting home from the gym and I took the stairwell downstairs. It was early morning. And there was a man who was homeless asleep in the stairwell of my building and, you know, ran upstairs, let the front desk know, like, hey. And her response was like, oh, yeah, someone just told me. I just called the police. And in my mind, I'm like, oh, is that the
right
solution? I mean, I guess it's private property. I guess it technically is a crime, but you know, it was a hypothermia warning. It was very cold. Like, that was probably a warm place he was able to get into. And yeah, it was scary just seeing a random person in the stairwell. But it was kind of thing of like, oh, are the police the people to handle this? Are they going to take him to a shelter?
Right. Like, could there be someone else tasked with that? And I mean, people sometimes say no. Like, this is, or some social workers want that sort of backing of the police when they go into situations. There are a lot of things that are the way they are because they've always been the way they are. And I think there's a lot of people that are saying, like, maybe we should rethink some of these systems, especially if we're concerned that it's going to be even easier to get into these criminalization cycles if the Supreme Court rules in a certain way.
On that policy reform front, you've done a lot of interesting reporting on, you know, a bunch of different solutions. I was recently reading an article you did about tiny homes. Like, is that a possible solution to all of this? Can you tell us a little more about that?
So tiny homes or tiny houses, or, you know, they go by little different names, but they fall into this category advocates call interim housing. So they kind of recognize, look, it's not an emergency shelter. It's not permanent housing, but it's something in the middle at a time when we need something in the middle because we don't have enough permanent housing to go around and it's going to take years. It's going to take a while to build that. So tiny houses are these things that really range in size and quality. So I think that's key. Like, not all tiny houses are created equal, but the thing to know about them is that they're obviously cheaper to build and they can be built much more quickly and they can kind of be built by avoiding a lot of the things that block regular housing, like zoning rules. Like, you can kind of build a tiny house on a plot of land for 3 years and then move it to another plot of land. And that sort of avoids some political fights that maybe like a new apartment building would encounter. So on the West Coast especially, and really in response to these Ninth Circuit decisions, there's been this explosion, especially since the pandemic, of these tiny houses as maybe a way to, you know, if you're going to clear out tent encampments, can you offer people a tiny house to go to? Because they might not want to go to a shelter because a lot of people have had really terrible experiences at these shelters that are like, no privacy, you can't bring your pet or your personal belongings. So maybe tiny houses can offer some more privacy and just like something as a bridge solution until we get more housing. Now, it's not a perfect solution. One of the problems is like, there's a real fear, I think, amongst advocates that they're going to take too much money and attention away from the ultimate goal of building affordable housing. And I think there's a little bit of fear that if you sort of turn down the political temperature on the crisis, then people will also lose the urgency to build permanent housing. Now, I'm honestly a little less convinced that that's the case because I've talked to people who live in these tiny houses and they say, look, this is a lot better than being on the street. I have somewhere I can use the bathroom. Like, not everyone wants to go there, but a lot of people do. And a lot of people do see it as a better alternative. But at the same time, those people do not see it as a permanent home. So I think the risk is, does the work stop after creating tiny homes and the problem is sort of like out of sight, out of mind? will there still be a lot of momentum to then build housing for them to go to? Or will people say, oh, well, now you're like at least off the street, so, you know, we can kind of move on to the next thing?
It's an election year, and we know that housing and homelessness are deeply connected. Are we hearing anything from the presidential candidates about addressing this, the housing and the homelessness?
We're not hearing much from Donald Trump about the housing crisis. And to the extent he's talking about homelessness, it's really just to sort of gin up fear about migrants and poorly run Democratic cities, as he likes to say. So he's only talking about homelessness to the extent that he can talk about crime in liberal cities. Joe Biden is actually talking more about the housing crisis. I just did an article for Vox recently on sort of how he's been ramping up all these different things about renting and home ownership. And he's kind of aware that people are upset with housing costs and that's messing up the like economy vibes he wants to sell. But he's not really talking about homelessness at all, which I think is a missed opportunity. And yet it kind of makes sense because people are really upset about homelessness and he doesn't really have a quick solution he can offer. But I think it's been coming up in a lot of West Coast elections a lot. So there's also a sense of like, can you really avoid talking about it or should you?
At the end of the day, it's all interconnected.
Exactly.
But like, I'm just thinking of there is a difference in needs and priorities and maybe what needs to be done for someone who does not have housing at all versus like, I don't know, I just got an email about rent going up and that's not right. fun. Right. But at the end of the day, there is a roof over my head.
And I mean, I will say the Biden administration, to its credit, like they have put out a lot of stuff about, you know, how they oppose the criminalization of poverty and how they discourage groups that are receiving federal funds from doing anything like that. The really complicated and very frustrating and very weedsy problem in America is that the entities that receive federal funding for homelessness are not the same entities that craft local homelessness policies. And so these like continuum care nonprofits, you know, are receiving the message not to criminalize homelessness, but it's like local city councils and other governments that they can only sort of recommend that. They can't really require it. And there aren't great levers for the federal government to rein in local governments on things like fining homeless people for sleeping outside. And that is frustrating.
Rachel Cohen, thank you so much for joining us on The Weeds.
Thank you for having me. I'm glad to be here.
The Supreme Court will hear oral arguments in Grants Pass v. Johnson on April 22nd, 2024. By the way, we just want to shout out Rachel because she really is that girl when it comes to reporting on this beat. Her reporting on tent encampments was even cited in an amicus brief in the Grants Pass case. To keep up with the latest, check out Rachel's reporting at Vox.com or follow her on X or Instagram at RMC031. That's all for us today. Thank you to Rachel Cohen for joining me. Our producer is Sophie Lalonde. Krishna Ayala engineered this episode. Melissa Hirsch fact-checked it. Our editorial director is A.M. Hall. And I'm your host, Jonquilin Hill. This podcast is part of Vox, which doesn't have a paywall. Help us keep it that way by going to Vox.com/give.